We're back on the record, and our tech support is working, so I have called the meeting to order. All members are now present. And we're going to start with House Bill 414. See that the sponsor is here. Welcome, Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm going to let my trusty aide, Mike, give the initial presentation. I'll answer any questions. He's kind of been the guru who's been following this and pushing.
This is one of those bills that's so simple even your staff can handle it?
They got to earn their keep.
I know.
That's what it's all about. Anyways, I'm Representative Pete Cott, District 17, and this is my trusty aide.
Okay, Mike.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. Mike O'Hare, staff to this gentleman right here on my right, Representative Pete Cott. Before you is House Bill 414. It's about protecting kids from unhealthy, seedy characters, protecting them from predators. The bill's not complicated. We're going to decriminalize parents' actions as they monitor their child's conversations. Parents in Alaska are breaking the law currently and are subject to criminal prosecution right now for the simple, reasonable act of picking up the phone to seeing whether someone's been preying on their child. Currently, if two people are talking on the phone, it's legal for a member of that party to record the conversation or authorize the recording of that conversation. It is currently illegal for a parent who suspects that their child's in danger, involved with these dangerous characters, to intercept the communications in order to protect them. The bill does two things. 414 allows for a court to enter into an ex parte order to authorize a wiretap only if the court determines that there's probable cause, which may include a finding that a parent of a minor has consented in good faith to this interception. And they have an objectively reasonable belief that it's necessary for the welfare of the minor. And also is in the best interest of the minor. There were some concerns on the House floor with regards to the issue of probable cause in Section 1. So we defined probable cause, to mean that the belief that the child or the person that the child is in communication with is committing a felony or a misdemeanor or has been or is about to be a victim or a witness to a felony or misdemeanor. Or the health or safety of the minor is in danger. 414 also allows a parent or guardian of the minor intercept private communications of the minor, except for those communications between the minor's attorney, the guardian ad litem, or a child custody investigator. The information can be considered as evidence by a judge or guardian ad litem or a child custody investigator, or admitted in an official proceeding if it's found the parent is acting in good faith and has an objectively reasonable belief that the interception is necessary for the welfare of the minor and they're acting in the best interest of the minor. After a great deal of work and discussion regarding family issues, we've come up with the current version before you. While we recognize the potential issues in this legislation that our state constitution has a special interest to the right of privacy, it's not an absolute right. When the state has a compelling interest to protect the welfare of the children. Clearly, the subject creates some tension between protecting kids and the potential for parental mischief, if you will. But with the safeguards that we've incorporated in the bill, we believe we're doing the right thing for Alaska's families and creating minimal potential for abuse. We submit that the children's safety is worth any risk. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. O'Hare.
Mr. Chairman, I just might add, as Mike has indicated, under current law, if you're a parent and you want to monitor your conversation of your minor child in your home, it is illegal. You cannot pick up a third party and listen in, regardless of what you might think might be happening, which is, in my mind, just unconscionable. And I think during the testimony to the various committees in the House, there were several of us who said, well, we've committed a violation of the law. We've broken the law. And that's probably true. I think, you know, as we have dealt with a number of issues in this legislature over the years in tightened the reins and placed greater responsibility on parents, it's, I think, behooving that we give them tools, if we're placing that responsibility on them, tools to deal with the issues at hand. I can recall one issue as of recent times where we have said that if your child is defacing an educational facility, a school, then it falls upon the parent then to make good on that. So we're responsible for taking care of the problem that our kids get into. So in order to do that, if we're going to assume that we're going to be responsible for this stuff, then we should have the opportunity to at least to cut that kind of mischief off at the pass, if you will. And that's what this bill does. It does nothing more than allows the parent to monitor, you know, under reasonable conditions the oral conversations between their minor child and another party. Now, again, under current law, you have to have consent of one of the two people that are engaged in the oral conversation before you can monitor that. So this negates that and puts an exception into the eavesdropping law, which is, I think, worthy of your deliberations and discussion.
Okay. A couple questions. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 1, it's adding a new section. Make sure I'm reading this correctly. And there's a lot of stuff about felonies and misdemeanors and a whole bunch of stuff that has nothing to do with a minor. Maybe it does. I guess I got a little bit confused in the construction of that and why we have the first part, page 1, lines 10 through 15.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to be off of what you guys are trying to do. And I don't know if that's current law that we needed to put in here or if that's new law.
Senator Guest, through the chair, on the floor, on the House floor, there was a concern about probable cause. It wasn't defined. There was originally, it was just the court may enter an order based on probable cause. Probable cause of what was the question. So in order to answer the question, we defined it to be that criteria. Whether the child or the party that they're communicating with is in the process of committing a felony or a misdemeanor, a witness to a felony or a misdemeanor, or a victim of a felony or misdemeanor, or that the child's life, health, and safety was in danger.
How does this tie in with federal law?
Mr. Chairman, it ties nicely in with federal law. It doesn't violate the federal eavesdropping statutes. There are a number of cases out there within the various circuit courts, court of appeals in various districts, and it dovetails in with some of them and the other ones. I mean, there's a variety of issues out there when you go back and look at federal law where some of the states have activated a similar situation as this and some have not. I mean, it's in the Ninth Circuit, we're completely in compliance at this point.
Is there, when we define parent, we've defined parent, a natural parent. How about step parent?
Mr. Chairman, page 4, line 12 defines a parent. It means a natural person who is a minor's natural or adoptive parent or has been legally appointed as the minor's guardian.
So what do we do with a stepmother or a stepfather?
I don't know, actually. We have Annie Carpinetti here. She might be able to answer the question for you, sir. Good point.
Annie?
I think that if the step...
Why don't you come up and sure. If you could just...
the chair. I believe, my name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. I think if the step-parent does not, is not an adoptive parent, then he or she cannot consent.
Do we want to include step-parents in this process, Representative Cott?
Well, that's clearly up to the committee's prerogative.
What was your intent?
I would have no problem in doing that, in allowing for that to occur.
In today's world, I know so many, we have so many mixed families that I know we allow for step-parents and other things in the law at many other places to have pretty much the same rights as a natural parent in some respects, you know, as far as, I'm just curious as to what your intent was, if it was to preclude them or if it was just an oversight.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it was more of an oversight, something that we really didn't perceive as an issue at the time, but I can see where it could be.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Guess?
Could this be, if we go to, let's just say, page 1, lines 11 and 12, has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a felony or misdemeanor, could this be used for one parent to get access to a child talking to the other parent? I guess only because I think all of us have heard, seen, or been around some nasty separations between parents. And could you have a situation if one of the parents was, had committed a felony or misdemeanor in the past and say, well, I want to go get a court order to listen into my son's conversation with his father? I don't think that was the intent. I guess I'm looking to Annie about, I don't necessarily want to give another tool to people who are in some dueling divorce situation, putting the kid in the middle of it, unfortunately, as this happened. Could that happen with this?
Well, I think, through the chair, do you want me to respond to that? I think that the concerns for domestic situations like that were addressed on page 3, which put a lot of limitations on when a parent can, under what circumstances a parent can consent to a wiretap on the child. We have actually concerns about that, the Department of Law does, which I'd like to address at some point whenever you're ready to hear it. I don't know whether now is the right time, because...
Look to see if there's other questions first, and we can look at that. Senator Terrio?
I just had a question on page 3, line 21, good faith. Acting in good faith. I'm just wondering what that means.
So. Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrell, that's going to mean what the court determines what it means. I mean, when this goes to a court, the judge is going to have to make a determination what is good faith, if the parent's acting in good faith on behalf of the minor. And it's what it might mean to Judge X, and it might mean what it is to Judge Y. I think it behooves the parents to make sure that they can legitimize whatever their claim might be to a court, that they're acting in good faith. I mean, it's, I don't know, Annie.
Well, that's a concern. We have one of our concerns is what does good faith mean in these circumstances. I don't think it's very clear, and that's why we would raise that as a concern.
Hey, Senator Guess?
Mr. Chair, along those lines, Annie, on page 2, lines 3 through 5, parents' objectively reasonable belief.
What page are you on?
Oh, I'm sorry, page 2, line 4.
That's also on page 3, line 22.
Oh, is it? Oh, it is.
I may be looking at the wrong version.
It's the, the extension of Senator Terrio's question, whether or not there's, we know what it, page 2, line 4?
Just the term objectively reasonable belief.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's in two places.
Oh, okay.
In two places.
I obviously, okay. Right after. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong draft. Objectively means to
Those terms are defined, though?
Well, objectively reasonable person is a term that we use pretty often in legal interpretations. It means to a person, not necessarily a subjective belief by this particular person.
Okay.
It's a reasonable person standard.
Other questions? Ms. Carpinetti, for the sponsor. Anything else for the sponsor? Seeing none. Ms. Carpinetti, have you got concerns that you want to express to us?
Oh, we do. Our division has been working with Representative Cott, and we have supported the bill up until, and we were very happy with the House Judiciary Committee version of the bill. We are concerned with the provisions in the Rules Committee substitute that was amended, and our main concerns are the provision, for example, the parent acting in good faith. That's a concern of ours. But our main concern is on lines 28 through 5 on page 4. These are limits to what evidence is admissible that is obtained by overhearing a child's communication.
Sorry, which lines on page
3? I think you're on a different version of the bill.
So I'm on page three, line 28.
Starting with
evidence obtained under this paragraph may be.
Okay.
That is kind of strange. I had been working under the unamended rules version, but.
You're talking about evidence obtained under this paragraph may be A, B, C, so on.
Right, exactly.
At that point, which starts on line 26 on page 3.
Yeah, and the main concern is on line 31. It's admissible in court only if this paragraph has been satisfied. And it's very limited. I mean, these are standards where you can wiretap a child. But suppose a parent is in a home and has a hunch about his or her children and wants to overhear a conversation, a telephone conversation. I think it's in everybody's best interest that that parent be able to listen to that conversation on less than probable cause, on a hunch that their child is in danger, and that that evidence should be admissible in a court of law if necessary. If you think somebody is making plans to prey on your child, way short of probable cause, I think it's the parent's duty to overhear that conversation, and that evidence, whatever he or she gathers, ought to be admissible in a court of law. And this really limits that.
I would tend to agree with that. Can you tell me what the apologetic was for the amendment that did this?
I think Representative Cott might be able to explain that to you. We're sort of stretched in the Department of Law, so people who've worked on this bill are in other places.
What was the argument? You turn that microphone toward you there.
Mr. Chairman, this was a Representative Gruenberg amendment. He argued vehemently for it. Was able to admit it into the bill. Frankly, I objected to the amendment, but
how would you re-amend the bill, Representative Cott?
I think I would defer to Annie. Maybe just delete that.
How would you propose that this be
delete that section?
Well, we would like to go back to the House Judiciary Committee version, and maybe with a addition of step parent, if that's what the committee desires, as a person who is
we
able
have a
to
copy of the House Judiciary version.
Should be in the packet there. I only have the current version.
Me too.
I have it.
Probably.
We can.
There's so many.
Could just take a minute and ask Brian to scoff the record for a moment. We're going to go back on the record. Mr. O'Hare, could you tell us the differences between the Judiciary Committee on the House side and the rules as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First, differences in the Section 1. There are, in the Judiciary version L Lima that we're looking at now, and the current version P as in Papa dot A, the Section 1 does not have the probable cause definitions. It basically identifies probable cause, but that we have not defined the probable cause issues. And the other change is on page of the Judiciary version L on page 3, line 13, we have the ninth exemption, exempting the parent's interception of the minor's communication. And it does not include the evidentiary definitions in there. Nor does it have the inclusion of a child custody investigator. So in the Judiciary version on page 16, sorry, on page 3, line 15, starting at 14, the interception of a private communication between a minor and the minor's attorney or guardian ad litem, and we have included also a child custody investigator in the current version. And I believe those are the differences, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Guest.
Yes, Annie.
Annie?
Annie.
Thank you, Mr. O'Hare.
You're welcome.
Scott, if we could just get you to the center.
Thanks.
You have to be either on the right or the left.
Could you hand my file, please? Thanks.
Good place to be.
Yeah, good place to be.
Oh, thanks.
Ms. Carpinetti, yes. Your comments, please.
Annie, can, on Section 1, he said that in rules we don't have a good definition of probable cause. And I'm going to look at my attorney friend across from me and ask you, I don't know, maybe I always assumed that we did. I mean, is there a reason to put this definition in, or is probable cause defined well enough in the structures of the courts that we know what it means? I mean, or maybe Senator French wants to.
I think Ms. Carpinetti is the best person to answer that.
Well, I think probable cause is a very common standard that courts apply. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
That's what I thought, but since they said that they needed to define it in rules, I didn't really understand. I thought maybe I misunderstood for the last 6 years.
I don't think you did.
Okay.
According to my understanding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Carpinetti, is there? Would there? I think. Well, let's just wait a second. I would prefer that we use the judiciary, the House Judiciary Committee substitute, or for our working document rather than the House Rules Committee substitute as amended. So I think what I'd like to do is we have a copy before us of the Lima version of the CS for House Bill number 414, Judiciary Committee. And I would like to take that version and adopt it as a Senate Committee Judiciary substitute. May substitute with that language in it as a working document for us to go forward.
So moved.
So Senator Huggins has moved the language contained in CS for House Bill 414 Judiciary, which is identified in the upper right-hand corner as L for Lima, to be considered, that draft to be considered a Senate Judiciary Committee substitute and as our working document. Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Now, with that, Ms. Carpinetti and sponsor, is there any objection to a conceptual amendment on line 20, page 3, to include in the definition of parent a step-parent living in the same home with the natural parent?
Mr. Chairman, that's fine.
What I'm trying to do at is get here is a... For an example, I have a son who's married, and there's one of his and two of hers and one of theirs, and if he believes that one of hers is in danger, I think he should have that same opportunity to protect that child, or vice versa. She should be able to do it for his.
Mr. Chair, I'll just...
Senator Guest.
Yes, I pause. Part of me does, and then part of me understands that those are very delicate situations and that the natural parent is the one that's ultimately accountable for the child. And you normally have another step-parent somewhere else.
I understand that, too.
So it can be more complex in those situations.
I agree with that. My son works about 12 hours a day. My daughter-in-law is there with the children most of the day, and I would not want to say that for some reason she should not have the same ability to try to look out for the welfare of that child. Senator French?
I share some of Senator Guest's concerns, but I think the what I heard you say, Mr. Chairman, was that it was the step-parent living in the same home.
With the natural parent.
I think that lowers my concern that there'd be some, you know, sort of extended family or a breakup of the family and a step-parent visiting, and they're... I think we all see this as a defensive measure, not an offensive measure, and I think that as long as the family's living together, I see it as, you know, a protective unit.
That's how I see it, too.
Okay.
Is there any objection? Oh, that's a conceptual amendment that the chair would entertain.
I'll move that.
Senator French has moved that we include in the definition of parent a step-parent living in the same home with a natural parent. Is there objection? Hearing none, that amendment, this conceptual amendment, will be adopted. Now, there was another definition of another term or an inclusion of a term, Mr. O'Hare.
Mr. Chairman, on page 3, line 14, this is, I'm looking at the judiciary version, where it lists some exceptions. Excuse me. We also want to ensure that the child custody investigator is one of those exceptions. It's been brought to my attention that there's a child custody investigator that's also could be part of this equation, and we don't want those.
So let's say line 15 after the word attorney, you could put comma, child custody investigator, comma, and then complete it out, or guardian ad litem is not exempt from the provisions?
That's correct.
Is there someone that would offer an amendment to that effect?
I'll move that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator French has moved to amend line 15 after the word attorney to insert comma, child custody investigator, comma, so that that line would now read communication between a minor and the minor's attorney, child custody investigator, or guardian ad litem. Is there objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest.
I guess we also need to address on how the drafter addresses if they define step-parent or redefine parent, you may have to have another amendment on page 3, line 14, depending on how they write the other section.
Priority by a parent. If it's in, it's included in the definition of parent, I think that would be okay.
And that's what your motion was
before,
to include it in the step-parent in the definition of parent. Okay, great.
Senator French?
What does this do about big brothers and sisters? If a 17-year-old brother listens in on a conversation of a 13-year-old brother or sister, where does that fall in this scheme?
I think it, through the chair, I think it depends on the circumstances. I think this is private overhearing of conversations, and I think it would be addressed based on the circumstances. I think it would be admissible if it were a brother, no police participation in the overhearing. I mean, it wouldn't be an exception to the wiretapping, which is what we're accepting here.
But if a 17-year-old brother picked up the telephone and listened to his 14-year-old brother, being enticed or solicited or whatever it is that we're worried about in this bill, would that 17-year-old brother be able to walk into court and testify to the conversation?
Through the chair, I believe so. I mean, we're amending wiretapping statutes here. That would be just picking up the phone in the context. I mean, I assume if they were out at a restaurant, it would be something, you know, someplace else besides the home. But generally, evidence gathered by a private person is not subject to the Fourth Amendment. And depending on the circumstances, I would hope it would be admissible.
Sure. And so, then I guess I'm back to wondering why we have to worry about a parent being subject to the same constriction.
Well, because this is for wiretapping, and I think the sponsor was concerned that wiretapping of the child by a parent is not accepted in our wiretapping statute.
Okay, I guess I just need a little more.
It's a little narrower.
Right. So we're talking about like putting a listening device on the telephone and capturing all the conversations that occur in the home. That's the
idea. Or like a cell phone outside the home, maybe, if you have a warrant to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Are further amendments to the bill? Seeing none. Senator French.
What just so we're clear on what we took out under the old version, on pages 3 and 4, there were a series of steps that I know you had some heartburn with. Have we lost anything by taking out what the evidence gathered through the wiretap can be used for?
Yes.
And maybe you can just articulate that for me one more time.
Well, the Rules Committee version said that the evidence gathered could be only used if it was gathered under these circumstances that are set out in the main paragraph. This does not address when it can be used, and I would assume that as long as police aren't involved in the overhearing, that it would generally be admissible, subject to whatever objections that a person would make, that it, for some reason that I'm not thinking about right now, it shouldn't be.
They simply can't object that it violated the wiretap statutes.
Right.
And Chairman Seekins asked a good question, I thought, some time ago about whether this state law complies with federal law, with Title III wiretaps. Do you think this is in conformity with those laws, or is it different from them?
Through the chair, I would defer to the chairman on that because he knows more about it. I assume that all of our Title 42 wiretap exceptions do comply with federal law because we have to. And I don't think
Scott, you have looked into that.
Huh? I've looked into that, and we do. This is in compliance. I mean, federal law is silent, and we're in compliance.
Okay. The one thing that I see that we've done, Senator Branch, is under probable cause, the Rules Committee really narrowed it down as to what there was probable cause of, where now we've widened it to basically that it's necessary for the welfare of the minor. We've really broadened the scope of what probable cause is. Am I right?
Well, not necessarily. It's interesting the way they did it in because they did provide on page 2, and I'm looking at the rules. Is that the rule?
Rules.
I'm looking at the Rules Committee substitute amended on page 2, lines 2 through 5.
Okay.
Also provided that you could.
Yeah, I got it. I see it there.
They just broke it down into adding other things to it. I think the House Judiciary Committee is perfectly acceptable.
Okay. Are there other amendments that we want to propose to the bill? Senator Huggins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I know we adopted Lima for conversation, but we steered away from a version that had been amended. Could you, maybe the amendment had some good intentions and rules. I'm just trying to figure out what that amendment really did.
Do you want to take that?
You said that was by Representative Bloomberg, right, in House rules?
Yes, and I was not present. But what the words say, and so I don't know what his stated intention was, but it limits the interception to and makes the state prove that the parent was acting in good faith, which is a problematic standard, and has objectively reasonable belief that the interception is necessary for the best interest of the minor. And our position is that as a parent protecting the child, you want them to be able to act on less than probable cause. You want them to be act on a suspicion or a hunch that their child is might be in danger. And it's, we think it's perfectly appropriate for parents of minors to do that. And then it limited the circumstances under which the evidence gathered under these circumstances would be admissible in a court of law to those circumstances where it was intercepted under that standard. And, you know, it seems reasonable that our response to that is, you know, if a parent stumbles over some evidence that his or her child is being harmed or is potentially being harmed, that evidence ought to be admissible. It's, you know, it's private action. Police aren't involved. Generally, evidence gathered by private people with no police involvement is admissible, and it should be to protect the children. And what his, I think his stated purpose was concern over domestic.
That's correct.
Concerns.
Yeah.
Ms. Senator Hoggins.
Yeah. Well, number one, I say thank you for pointing that out to us. I mean, that disturbs me, I guess, for lack of a better term. You know, I have my own Huggins common laws when it comes to parenting, and I would have little regard for that amendment to begin with. But quite frankly, I'm affronted by the fact that, you know, we're making attempts to further erode parental responsibility, I'll say. And, you know, parents are confused enough now in our society without us further eroding that. So I say thank you very much for bringing that to attention so we do not fall into that steel trap.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Cotter, are there any further amendments that you'd like to see to the bill?
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone that wants to testify on the bill online?
No.
Anyone in the audience? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Discussion by the members. Senator Huggins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that CS for House Bill number 414, Virgin Lima, be moved as amended with individual comments and physical note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved on to the next committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
And we'll take a short recess.
Thank you.
we're back on the record. Next, we have the House Bill 190, and we have staff for the Majority Whip here to present it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Bull, Representative Foster's office. What you have before you is House Bill 190. Sum up, basically, Alaska already has some of the strictest DUI laws in the nation, and yet approximately 30% of our fatal motor vehicle collisions involve DUIs. What House Bill 190 does is put forth a new approach in trying to decrease that number of alcohol-related accidents by preventing the drivers from getting their hands on the alcohol in the first place. What HB 190 would do was put a display on a state-issued ID or driver's license that would say ROC, standing for Restriction on Consumption. It would alert, you know, vendors that this person is not eligible to purchase alcohol. While it does provide financial incentive in line with the incentive covered in the provisions for underage drinking, it still remains voluntary for the vendors to do so. This is a strong step towards preventing DUIs, and I urge your support. I'll take any questions.
Questions? Senator Huggins.
I don't know. You know, I'm just thinking of the practicality. I don't own a restaurant, but just for a moment, for a scenario. If I owned a restaurant, why I would run the potential risk of, in this case, asking for the ID of a customer to run the customer off. I mean, I see that as potential consequences. I mean, I'm against drunk driving and all the implications of that. I'm just wondering the practicality of myself as a proprietor of a restaurant telling, or myself going and say, I want to see your ID card for you to have a glass of wine or a shot of whiskey. Thoughts? I'm sure you probably didn't ask that before.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that was addressed actually in our first hearing. Char was opposed to the bill, and on that very basis, and that's why it remains voluntary for them to check.
Yeah, but I guess that's my point. Would the proprietor do that? I don't know the answer. I mean, you're sponsoring the bill. I see Representative Crawford sitting there squirming. So,
Representative Crawford, do you want to join us? You can bring that microphone around if you would. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Huggins, through the chair.
Put your name on the record, please.
Harry Crawford, representative from Mouse District 21. And there are a number of proprietors that would like the ability to do this. Not all of them want that ability, and we don't want to force that upon them. But for those that already do check, and others that have expressed the desire to have this knowledge, we want to give that to them.
Just for the record, Char is Cabaret Hotel and Restaurant Owners, so an organization of those owners. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank the sponsors for bringing us this bill. I've considered doing something like this myself, and I'm glad you guys had the initiative to get the ball rolling and get it as far as you have. I agree with Senator Huggins. I think the sort of the final missing link is requiring restaurants to perform this check, but I just don't think that's gettable, and it's not workable at this time. And so I think this is about as far as you can go with the bill, you know, for what both the outside the building and inside the building are willing to accept. But I'd be happy to hear any thoughts you have about that. It looks like you have something on your mind.
Senator French, through the chair, I think the main problem with requiring them to check is liability. You might run into the situation where somebody who is not allowed to drink was carded, somebody didn't notice the insignia, or perhaps an employee chose not to card, even though law requires it. Now, if that person is arrested, has to go back to jail for parole violations, perhaps loses their jobs, they may have recourse to sue the vendor.
for not preventing them from drinking?
Well, it seems to me what we've got is we've got in here the ability for the vendor to sue the person, but no penalty for the vendor if they don't exercise due caution. So what would keep a vendor from running a pretty neat little entrapment scheme here? I know, Representative Crawford, you're not supposed to be drinking. But I can go ahead and serve you if I want to without any penalty whatsoever. But the minute you start to consume it, I can get a $1,000 civil penalty against you for doing that.
Mr. Chairman, that $1,000 incentive is the reason for this bill, because the fact that the offender or perpetrator, whatever we want to call him, has that $1,000 hanging over his head at any place that he were to go, whether it was a Costco or a Brown Jug or a restaurant, knowing that he's in the wrong by being in there trying to buy alcohol to consume. That's the trigger here that we're looking for.
Right. But I'm saying I can sell him all I want to, and then go collect my $1,000.
It was the perpetrator's fault for being in there in the first place and putting himself in that situation.
Right. I just think it's a little bit hypocritical to in this situation. I understand the opposition is coming from those people who don't want to card people. I understand that. But I don't want to be able to reward someone for turning someone else in if there's no penalty for them to go ahead and serve or sell.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but there was just no way that I could get this through. I want to do something to change the way, change what we're doing.
Right
now, we're not making the dent in drunk driving and alcohol-related crimes.
Believe me, I have no argument with your intent. You know, I, for the record, I don't consume alcohol, so I'm not so worried about it. But not that I don't think people would like me very much if I drank alcohol. I don't have any inhibitions already. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the bill will have at least probably the most market effect on folks that are under 30. Folks closer to 21 that typically get carded are going to experience the most difficulty in getting alcohol once this bill becomes law. So there will at least be some measurable effect, I think, there. Where it will have less effect, I believe, is as you get older and older and you get carded less and less. Folks ask for your birthday now when you go and buy alcohol, but you rattle that off and then you're good to go. So, again, I agree with the sponsors. This is a step in the right direction, and we may be able to make it tighter in the future.
Senator French, from through the chair, not only will it have an effect there, but I believe that many of the other customers that frequent me, have neighborhood bars and all that they've frequented for years, I believe that will also have an effect on them as it becomes known. It's a matter of public record when somebody gets convicted of DUI, and I believe that it will have an effect on those repeat offenders as well.
Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the sponsors. This is something actually my district has been asking for a long time, and Representative Crawford and I, our areas touch each other. Only for DUIs, not other alcohol-related crimes. Can you talk through, because there has been some talk in the past of if it seems as if every time you drink, you're getting in trouble, then maybe we should put this restriction on you. But this is just for DUIs. Can you talk through why you just chose for this right now?
Senator Guest, from through the chair, we started out me having it as all felony alcohol offenses, but what we found out was that we don't have good communication between different branches of our government, and the for DUIs it's already set up to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles. Mm-hmm. So to keep that large fiscal note off of it, we went with the DUIs. Let's try this. This is the so-called pilot program. Let's see how this works and refine it in the coming years.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Crawford, the privacy of your home, if I have on my driver's license all the indications of I shouldn't be drinking, it's still legal for me to do that in my home?
I don't believe so. Under the law right now, when the judge orders, it's not to enter or consume. That's we don't enforce it now because nobody knows who those folks are. But the orders are not to enter or consume. So
that's current law.
And all we're doing is identifying the people that are under those orders.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'd be interested, Ms. Carpinetti, about whether you can still do it in your home or not. Drugs or alcohol, either one.
If the judge orders you not to consume alcohol, I think that you are under an obligation not to consume it anywhere.
Ms. Carpinetti's response was, the judge orders it, you're not to consume it anywhere, just for the record.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about both drugs and alcohol. It appears to me in some cases in the state we get a little confused and kind of interesting how we as a society are approaching some of these things. But I know if you look at statistically in some of the neighborhoods I live in, the accidents that involve deaths, over 50% of them have drugs and alcohol involved with them. My concern is that this bill really, and I understand, you know, your background and your family background, and I'm very compassionate about that. I'm not so sure that this does anything substantive. It may make all of us feel better and say we're nipping at, but I'm not so sure that it does anything. And I say that genuinely, because you and I talked about this before.
Go ahead, Representative Crawford.
Through the chair. It's over 1,000 times already. They've used this on the underage drinkers. It has severely changed how many underage drinkers are buying alcohol. I believe that it's going to have an effect on repeat offenders older than 21 as well. I'd like to give it a try. I mean, it may not be the end all and be all, but what we're doing is not effective. So let's try something new and see if we can make it have a better effect.
Yeah, no, I understand. I just think of scenarios as an example. I mean, I have multiple IDs, or I just use one of the IDs that has a picture and has my birth date, so I bypass that piece of it. I'm just applying it to myself. If there are two other people sitting at the table, the person to my immediate left, I'm just looking at scenarios that it just appears to be have so many loopholes in it that it's not effective. And I am supportive of the concept that you're after. I'm not so sure that we get at it, and I'm not trying to pick at you or anything else. I'm just being candid and frank about, you know, my perception, because when you and I talked about it, I gave it great thought after that, because we share some of the same concerns, and I have compassion for what your family and other families have gone through, some of my neighbors, but I'm just not sure that this gets us much.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gitt. Yes.
I think Senator Huggins brings up good points, and I think the difficulty is if we wanted to do something where we knew that it was going to have an exact impact, and that impact, honestly, couldn't get through the process. And it's such a I mean, I've worked on this issue, and Representative Crawford has, and the stakeholders and the issues and the logistics of it all get to a situation where it's not I wish it was possible. It's not at this time. So, I mean, I kind of see this new revised bill as taking that step and the let's see what happens. Let's not kid ourselves. This isn't, if someone wants to drink and drive, they're gonna do it. We're not going to be able to stop them. What we're trying to do is put some speed bumps in so maybe some of those folks decide not to. That maybe we can deviate some of them. And that's how I look at this version of the bill and the progress that's been made.
Yeah. Senator Huggins.
But if I might, and I'm not trying to pick details, but is that this bill, I know, has an implication about driving, but it's not about drinking and driving. It's about the fact that you're excluded from drinking and the fact that you drink. I mean, that's the violation, not drinking and driving. I know that what we don't want to have is a drunk person driving. I mean, I understand that, but what we're getting at here is not about drinking and driving. It's about drinking when you're excluded for, or precluded from drinking legally.
And the difference between this and the Hey Mister law is a couple things. In that the Hey Mister law, you know, there's a penalty for serving a minor. There is a liability that attaches with that, and it is a little easier sometimes to determine this guy may, just because of the aging process, might not be old enough. I mean, you can tell the difference between a 16-year-old and a 60-year-old pretty easily. But the question I come around to is, you know, and I understand if it was up to me, and someday it may be, but I would say someone who has been convicted of a crime that where alcohol was the factor, I don't care what it was, or other drugs, that they should be prohibited from being able to purchase, possess, or consume any amount. And, mm-hmm. And I have,
you know, every time I go to the airport, I came back from the funeral service for our mayor's wife yesterday from Fairbanks, got on the airport, I showed him my ID. I had to show it to him when I got the ticket. I had to show it to him when I got to the screening area. You know, anymore, I mean, there is not an adult in the world that doesn't understand that in order to have passage to certain areas, you're going to have an ID available. We've gotten used to, as a society, saying, you know, for certain purposes, we need to have an ID and be able to show it, and it better be a real ID. And so, you know, I kind of object. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to deter me here, but to an organization that says, well, we want to be able to go after somebody maybe 1,000 times in a short period of time, because we passed that. That Hey Mister law came through this committee, 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. And then we had to go in and make an exception so that when we set up a sting operation, that they couldn't file a lawsuit, civil suit, against the people that we had in a sting operation.
Right.
You know, so they've not always dealt in good faith on this issue either. And by saying, well, we want to be able to sue someone and get that civil penalty, but we don't want any penalty if we choose not to. That's very hypocritical to me. Representative Crawford.
Mr. Chairman, when I came to the legislature 6 years ago, Representative Joe Green had a similar bill that did much the same thing. The difference was that everything was mandatory, and he was never able to get it through the legislature. My wife went, I mean, it endangered her life, and it it has drastically changed her life and the lives of my family. And had Joe Green been successful in getting a bill through, I don't know that it would have saved my wife from what she had went through, but it may have. We don't know how many times we might have saved a life, those thousand times that the Hey Mr. Bill has worked. I don't purport this to be the perfect bill. I'm sure it's not, but I believe it's a start, and I have never tried to push a more important piece of legislation than this.
Right. I appreciate it. Let's take just a break here, and we've got one person online for questions, and it's Dwayne Bannock from DMV. Dwayne, are you with us?
I just got a
You got? Okay. Dwayne, are you there?
Good morning, Senator. I am. Yes, sir.
Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dwayne. Logistically, how would this work in the DMV department?
Senator Seekins, I can tell you that the Division of Motor Vehicles has spent a tremendous amount of time with Representative Crawford's office, on this office, kind of talking through exactly how we can and would implement this should it become law. I can tell you that our suggestions have been gratefully received, and there's some milestones within the bill itself, some timing points that, as you heard earlier testimony, the Division of Motor Vehicles does have contact with the court system in cases of both DUIs, and I say when I say DUIs, that also includes failures to submit to chemical testing. Those are one and the same for punishments at the DMV. So while it is true that we do get notifications in those cases, there will have to be some additional notification that includes that in this particular case, the person is also under this new court order, because it's important to note that not every DUI offender is covered or would be subject to this. As far as the practical applications of creating a mark, per se, on the card, that will take minimal programming, and we will do that. I hope that answers that question of how the process itself works.
Mr. Bannock, let me explore it just a little bit. Let's say that a person is convicted, and as the judge says, you can't drive, or you're going to have to give up your driver's license, or you can't purchase alcohol anymore for this period of time. I'm assuming at that point in time, then, in order for this to work, the judge would have to take physical possession, the court would have to take physical possession of the driver's license until it got reissued, showing that the mark was on there. Is that how you would envision that?
Senator, that's very close to accurate. Oftentimes, when a person is apprehensive, it is the policeman that actually takes the driver's license away. Unfortunately, by the time we get to this point in the court process, the customer may have already served perhaps a mandatory DMV suspension period, received a new driver's license from the DMV, and then months down the road when they are actually in front of the judge and the judge gives this sentence, I think that is a very likely scenario.
So what kind of notification does DMV get that the police officer has taken their driver's license away that would keep them from coming back into DMV and saying, you know, I lost my driver's license and need a duplicate?
Regretfully, Senator, that is quite a problem. It takes transmission time. If a person is arrested at midnight tonight, we're not going to know about it for a couple of days. The policeman will actually take their driver's license away at midnight tonight, and tomorrow morning at 8:30 when we open, that same customer could walk into the DMV, say, by golly, I lost my driver's license last night, sign a document stating that, and we would, for $15, cheerfully reissue a new driver's license.
Okay. And how about in the court, same way, if the judge took it away, is there a relatively seamless communication system between the courts and DMV to be able to preclude the same thing from happening, or would the same scenario be probable?
Senator, relatively seamless is a big box.
Yep.
We do have a communication path. It is not immediate. I believe as part of this bill, one of the amendments put a 2-day window in it, I believe, in the latest version of this bill. In 2 days, clearly the customer could come in, and since we are, it's important that we note that we're talking about criminals. The reason that they are in this predicament is because they have broken the law. And what's to say that they're not going to just carry 2 driver's licenses in their pocket by an affidavit telling the DMV that they've lost it, which indeed circumvents the entire intent of this bill.
Okay. So a person could retain their original license, sign the affidavit, get a duplicate, so in case they had their license taken away from them, it would be, they'd have another one in the wallet already.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Guess?
Yes. Dwayne, that can occur now, though, correct? Because it wouldn't just be with this bill. The licenses get taken away. I mean, that's a problem that we have now in the current system.
Senator, through the chair, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
However, with one small exception, if the customer were to do that today, because there's no physical difference between the license itself, if the person gets stopped for blowing the red light, for instance, and the police officer says, "May I see your driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance?" When the police officer then reports that driver's license to either his dispatcher or his mobile data terminal, it will show that the driving privileges of that customer have been suspended. So it basically unvalidates the plastic piece of the driver's license card that the customer has in his hand in a law enforcement issue, because law enforcement will verify the validity of the driver's license, because just because the person has it in his pocket doesn't mean that they have the privilege to drive. This bill does not address that avenue.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator French?
Got an easy one, Dwayne. Where will the initials ROC go on the license? Are they going to be big, small, down in the corner, right across the picture, where?
Senator French, through the chair, that's not an easy question yet, because we haven't gotten to that point. If this bill does become law, we will find a way to display ROC in such a form and fashion that it does not interfere with the necessary items of the driver's license that are otherwise statutorily required to be there.
Can you give me a little more information about that, or is it's still being worked out?
Senator, if you have, I'm sorry that I, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here by the telephone, by the way. If you have one of our new style driver's licenses that we affectionately refer to the digital driver's license, I would respectfully ask that perhaps you pull that out of your pocket. In the top left-hand corner, it says Alaska. Then there's a brief amount of space between that and the beginning of your name. Somewhere in that little area is probably where we would put it, in the same type of font as your driver's license number.
Just off the top of Pioneer Peak there.
Perhaps, sir.
Okay.
And you notice Senator French, and like on mine, I don't know about his, but there also is a designation. If you're an organ donor, you got a little red heart down at the bottom, same thing. And there is capability for them to be able to do that, and it's a good system. Mr. Bannock, appreciate it. Any other questions for Mr. Bannock? We appreciate your being online with us this morning, Dwayne. Dwayne, of course, I've known for a long time. He has had an honorable career in the automobile business before he came over to do DMV, and has done an outstanding job. I don't get anywhere near the complaints that I used to get before on DMV from my people in the dealership. So,
thank you very much, Senator. That credit goes to my staff in Fairbanks, Alaska.
I understand they're doing a good job, but we think you've done a bang-up job as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions? I don't want to unnecessarily hold this bill behind, but I'd like to spend a little time with the sponsor. We don't have anything scheduled heavy tomorrow, do we? Before?
but I would like to bring this thing forward. I'd like to just hear a couple of other bills on this, and then we'll finish this bill up in the morning. But there's a couple of questions I have. So with that, we'll just set this bill aside for a little while and bring it back up tomorrow morning, first thing on the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman.
Representative Lynn, did we lose Bob?
Not necessarily.
Let's take a short recess while we get Representative Lynn. Back on the record, we have with us this morning Representative Bob Lynn. And Representative Lynn, I believe we have your bill, House Bill 258, in front of us.
We do, Mr. Chair, and I'd also like to introduce Mike Seeker of my office, who will be, may have to fill in for me because our floor session has been delayed until 10:15.
If you'll introduce yourself to for the record, for
sorry, sir. Representative Bob Lynn, District 31, South Anchorage.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, honorable members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 258. And this bill makes rape or sexual assault by anyone infected with HIV/AIDS an aggravating factor at sentencing. And the key words here are rape and sexual assault. Now, how or why a perpetrator of rape or sexual assault acquired HIV/AIDS is not the issue. And the sexual orientation of the perpetrator is not the issue. And any perceived stigma associated with this life-threatening disease is, again, not the issue. So this bill is only, and I repeat, only about whether a convicted rapist or sexual predator previously diagnosed with HIV/AIDS should be subject to an aggravating factor at sentencing for this horrific and life-changing crime, and I think it should, and I hope you all agree. Not only does the victim of rape and sexual assault suffer the terrible consequences of the attack, the victim must also worry about the effects of life-threatening HIV/AIDS. This bill has received, I'm here to tell you, tremendous support from law enforcement and agencies for victims of sexual assault. In fact, Anchorage Police Chief Walt Monaghan described a sexual offender with HIV/AIDS as an assailant with an insidious weapon that can be used to further strike out against victims and their victims' loved ones. Susan Sullivan, where Victims for Justice said, and I quote, adding months of terror and possibly years of illness and a shortened life to the horror of rape makes an attack by HIV/AIDS positive rapist a horrendous assault, unquote. Jared Goffrey, chairman of the Violent Crimes Commission Board, urged passage of this bill, and again I quote, as a sign of respect, compassion, and understanding of the trauma experienced by victims of serious offenses, unquote. So far, 24 states have a law that specifically criminalizes exposure or transmission of HIV/AIDS, and I think it's time that Alaska joins them, considering their state has the highest rate of sexual assault and rape in the nation by far. This bill is a proactive measure that acknowledges additional pain and suffering caused by rapists and sexual assailants expose their victims to vicious attack and life-threatening diseases. A new section was recently added to the bill at the request of Senator Con Bundy's office to help clarify the language in Senate Bill 218, an important measure recently signed by the governor and on which I was a cross-sponsor. Under Senate Bill 218, an offender commits a crime of sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree when engaging in consensual sexual penetration with an underage person who is at least 4 years younger than the offender. Previously, the age difference required was 3 years, but inadvertently, this change to 4 years was also made in an offender for an offender in a position of authority. And this was not intended by the senator. The new section in my bill corrects this and keeps the law the way it was prior to the passage of Senate Bill 218. We do have witnesses available today to answer questions or even to testify if necessary. They can speak for law enforcement, domestic violence, and sexual assault agencies, Department of Law, and the Department of Corrections. They're available if you'd like to hear from them. In the interest of time, you may or may not, but most of them are here. Again, this bill is just one more step in making Alaska a safer place to live, to work, and to play, and I respectfully ask for your support.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, Senator Bundy and myself both asked Representative Lennon, he was agreed to put this change from 218. It was one that we realized once the bill had gotten transmitted and was an agreement between the administration and the sponsors to go to 4 years except in a position of authority. And we just had a drafting error in 218 that none of us caught. That wasn't the intent of 218. As we worked with the Office of Public Advocacy on that section. So I just wanted to clarify that and thank the sponsor for willingness to put that correction in. I did have one question on the bill, page 2, line 26. Yes. Expose the victim to a risk or a fear. The risk, I understand, but legally, how do you... Do we get in a situation with fear of someone who doesn't really understand about HIV or AIDS, and therefore you could use it as an aggravating situation because the person is fearful, even though nothing in the medical situation would support their fear, but it's mainly their misinformation about how the disease is transmitted?
You know, this, through the chair. This came up in the House Judiciary Committee, and the concern was that they put in the words involved penetration, and then they put in the risk, and they added the fear. As I understood it, the concern was there is some sexual contact that could be involved, that could create, like you said, a risk, and then also a fear that would at least lead to the exposure. Not necessarily the transmission of HIV/AIDS, and these victims go through, what is it, a 28-day period of preventative drugs they must take. It's very painful. A lot of them don't finish it. And the reason why they left it broad like that, I believe, is because under the aggravator laws, it is not a must. It is a may situation. The court considers all the issues and then may, and that is up to the discretion of the court. And if Susan Parks would like to add more to that, she could, if you're not satisfied with that answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm going to turn myself to the floor. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you,
Representative Lynn, for being with us this morning. Senator French had a question.
Thank you. And this pertains to Section 1, and maybe Senator Guest can answer it, or I see Susan Parks is here. But I'm just doing the arithmetic there on page 2, lines 15, 16, 17. And if a person's 18 years old, it looks like it'd be impossible for that person to be more than, or at least 3 years older than a 16 or 17-year-old person. Is there a reason why we picked 18, or should it be 19 instead, or has this all been, so someone got a magic answer here that explained my arithmetic issues?
Ms. Parks?
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Through the chair, Senator French, I think you're correct. The arithmetic doesn't make sense. However, the statute prior to SB 218 read this way. If you look at the statute book, and I've got it in front of me right now, that's how it currently reads, being 18 years of age or older, et cetera. So what this is doing is just returning it to the way it read prior to 218. The judiciary.
If the previous statute didn't make sense, what does make it sense? What does make sense?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to let you.
Mr. Chairman, you know, changing it to being 19 years of age or older is what I believe would make sense, because then you've got a 3-year age gap between 16 and 19, and so. I don't know if Senator Guess would have an objection. That certainly would probably read a little bit better, although.
Senator Guess?
Through the chair, we were trying to, this again in 218 got amended and it wasn't supposed to be amended, so we were just trying to get back to the original statute. And if it is an error in the current statute, I don't mind changing it and address Ms. Parks.
I would like to add, if you look at sexual abuse of a minor in the fourth degree, which involves sexual contact, which wasn't in SB 218, it currently reads, being 18 years of age or older, you engage in sexual contact with a person who is 16 or 17 years of age and at least 3 years younger. I guess I don't really want to slow this bill down necessarily, but I guess I would suggest either keeping it the way it is in the current CS, which the math doesn't make sense, or you may want to also make a change to sexual abuse of a minor in the fourth degree to make the same change to 19.
I think we should be marching towards
correctness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a member of arithmetic. Maybe we can.
Senator French, you have an amendment?
An amendment to page 2, line 15, to change the 18 on that line to being 19.
And also, what was the other one?
We'd have to bring in another
and
statute.
I haven't looked at SAM 3. Is there
yeah,
SAM
it would be
it as well.
Was it moved? No, it's sexual abuse of a minor in the fourth degree, 1141440, subsection little a 2.
We'd have to have a title change at that point, because we now would have in the fourth degree where we're addressing in second in the title.
Mr. Chair, I think you have the votes for it on the floor, so.
Yeah.
We could get the title change. That's not a problem.
I think we have time to.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, there's already going to be a title change on this bill because of the adding of Section 1, and it was going to be changed to an act relating to sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree, but you could just leave off in the second degree.
So, Senator French, your amendment would amend this section, paragraph 6, on line 15 to 19, and also, what's the other statute?
1141440, sexual abuse of a minor in the fourth degree, subsection A2.
I would move that as a conceptual amendment.
Okay. Is there objection? Hearing none. And also, we'll. This will require a title change already, so we'll have to get a. I don't think that requires us to vote on a title change. We just have to get a resolution to waive. So, but is there any objection to a title change from any of the members? Hearing none. Okay, let's. What else, Susan?
That was all I had to say. That we support the entire bill, including the aggravator. And I'm happy to answer any questions on either.
Okay. Amendment number 1 was adopted. Are there any other amendments proposed?
Just
Senator French?
Just a question for the record. I'm fairly certain this has come up before, where we've had assaults by folks who were infected with AIDS. How has that been handled up until now in sentencing?
Through the chair, Senator French, what we try to use would be probably most serious within the definition. We would probably try to use that aggravator. And frankly, that's become more difficult to use after the Blakely case. Before, we were able to just prove aggravators to a judge. Judges saw lots of cases come through the door and, you know, could distinguish between the more serious, less serious. That's a much more difficult sort of aggravator to prove to a jury. Do you bring police officers? Do you bring other prosecutors to talk about kind of the range of cases? And that's why we support this specific of a kind of aggravator for this kind of case. If we want to be able to aggravate those sexual assaults, and I think we do, this seems like an appropriate way to do it.
Okay. Other questions? Senator French?
Do you, Ms. Parks, do you have any concerns about the use of the word fear? I thought Senator Guess's questions were well put, and I just would like to hear the department's perspective on inclusion of a fear. Does it have to be a reasonable fear? Does it have to be, can it be an irrational fear? What do you see any constraints on that?
Through the chair, Senator French, I was not at the hearing where this was added on. But I mean, I think it would have to be a reasonable fear. I understand the concern. Part of our concern with just saying involving penetration was sometimes there's those cases where a jury may find an attempt, or they hang on penetration, but they convict on contact. But they would be able to find this kind of aggravator because of the risk, and you know, fear was just an additional word that they put in, and I'm not concerned that that's going to cause problems for us.
Senator French,
would the offender have to have AIDS for this aggravator to be made out?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator
previously
French.
Diagnosed.
Previously diagnosed, and part of this was, I mean, frankly, I don't believe the state would be proposing it in cases where they didn't actually have AIDS. I don't believe a judge would use it to aggravate a sentence when they didn't actually have AIDS. But what we wanted to get away from was there were proposals that the person had to knowingly have it. And what you have is a lot of people who maybe have a positive test. They don't do the follow-ups because, frankly, they want to live in denial and not know. And you know, if you're reckless in that way about whether you have AIDS or not, we believe this aggravator is still appropriate, and that was kind of what we're trying to catch with this wording, the people reckless as to whether they had AIDS or not.
Okay, any other questions? Hearing none, we have the bill as amended in front of us. I have a couple people who want to testify. Is anyone who want to testify against the bill? Seeing none, anyone else online? I'm not going to raise your hand if you're testifying in favor of the bill. Okay, we have two in favor of it out there. I'm not going to ask you to go on the record. No one is opposing the bill. Am I correct? Seeing none, we're going to close any public testimony. Discussion of the members.
Mr. Chair, where does the bill go from here? Does it?
Rules.
So should we wait to make sure we get the writing correct and then move it out tomorrow? Is there a problem with doing that?
I don't have a problem with that.
It doesn't. I mean, we have plenty of time, I think, to get it.
I don't imagine there would be much problem with concurrence on the other side at this point in time. What was the committee process on the other side? Was it smooth? Was it heavy? How'd the votes go?
In Hess, it was 7 due passes. In judiciary, it was everyone voted for it with one no recommendation. The rest were due passes. It voted 36-37-0 on the House floor.
I don't think there'll be any problem with concurrence, so I don't have any problem holding this till tomorrow so we can see the clean language. And if we can get you to work with us on that, that'll be good. So let's hold this bill until tomorrow until we can see the clean language. Next up on our...
Good job, Mike.
House Bill 442. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your help today. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony.
All right. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Sear Tupou, and I'm representing Representative Bruce Wyrock today. Before you, you have House Bill 442, and I'm sure most of you can remember in 2004 the Health Care Decisions Act that Representative Wyrock spent hundreds of hours working on. And so we've come back this year with some very minor changes, and I really want to stress that we've been very narrow in the construction of this bill because we really want a clean bill and we really don't want to open a whole lot of issues, so we've been very narrow in the construction. We've made a couple changes. Most of them have been just substituting in Uniform Act language for things that we thought might be problematic for those people that are actually implementing the health care decisions, generally doctors and health care providers. And so one change that we made, there's currently the legal standard is a reasonable legal standard in the current Alaska Act. And so we've substituted in there the Uniform Act language that says it's a good faith standard, so that those people that are implementing the healthcare decisions could do so with a little bit of reassurance. Another minor change that the bill makes, it just substitutes the word physician for attending physician. In talking with doctors, they felt like it was sort of a passe term. You sort of have an admitting physician and then numerous physicians that see you. So we just wanted to make it clear that all physicians that saw you should honor your advanced healthcare directives. It also substitutes Uniform Act language when we talk about bringing in DNRs or other advanced healthcare directives from other jurisdictions. So again, we've just substituted in the Uniform Act language, very, very narrowly constructed. And then it also just clarifies when a DNR can be revoked. And with that, I think it's just a really narrow construction that benefits all Alaskans so that we can let our wishes be heard. And it also helps those people that actually implement those wishes, that they're able to honor them with some kind of feelings that they are able to do so without possible litigation. So I think it's a win-win for all Alaskans and for healthcare providers, and we're excited to present this bill to you.
Okay. Questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Gass?
Thank you. And I worked a lot on the last bill and appreciate these changes. Can you explain the addition of the new section in Section 5 of the bill and just why? Because most of the stuff does look like it's conforming, but there's some new, and just why.
Through the chair, Senator Guest, that was sort of to address a specific situation. If you have a DNR, perhaps you have terminal cancer, and so you've got a do not resuscitate order, but you break your hip. You're in your 80s, you fell and you broke your hip. So now you want to go to the doctor and they're going to have to put you under and they're going to fix your hip. With anesthesia, it's not really an exact science the way some of the other ones are, because they're sort of bringing you down and then they bring you back. And so it's not an exact science, particularly with older people, they react differently. So say you have a DNR, but in the surgery you flatline. This says that they are able to do CPR and bring you back because they're rather just correcting their own mistake. Because if not, they could let you flatline, but then the family could come back and sue them for $5 million because, you know, maybe they didn't agree with that advanced health care directive. So it just lets doctors have some reassurance that they're able to correct their own mistake. So this section right here very narrowly just says if it's a secondary thing, so it's not the initial qualifying condition. It's a secondary matter. You're choking on a stake, you broke your hip, nothing to do with your initial qualifying condition, that a healthcare provider can do CPR at that point. So it's sort of a common sense thing that you would think, you know, obviously if you go in to get your hip fixed, you anticipate that surgery will go well and that the healthcare provider would do CPR and make sure that you get through that surgery. There's obviously that expectation because you've gone in for that elective surgery. And then it has some definitions there because as we talk to providers out in the field, EMTs, those people, they felt a little bit of, they weren't quite sure how they fit in there, and so they wanted to be exempt from that unless there was a, if you look there on page 3, line 18, it talks about they could have an online physician that was sort of guiding them, but they didn't want to have to make those decisions out there in the field, so we sort of exempted them from that provision per their request.
Senator French.
I have a follow-up question on that section. Section I sets out, and it says, notwithstanding the exception in E. And so then, so what I take Section I to be is an exception to the exception. And then Section J on line 10 begins by saying, the provisions of I of this section do not apply, and it goes on to talk about the instance when a healthcare provider performs emergency medical services to a patient in the field. I can't tell if that's an exception to the exception to the exception, or what it is, just from the construction. Is that the cleanest way we can write this?
Through the chair, I see your concern. I think that it's relatively clear. We also have Eric Jenkins online who could maybe speak a little more specifically to the language if you had concerns. But just to make it sort of clear, so I is just saying that you can do CPR if it has nothing to do with the initial condition. It's just a secondary condition. And then Jay just says, but if you're an EMT or someone out in the field that doesn't, you're not elevated to the level of a physician, then you don't have to make those decisions. So, but if you are not sufficient with that answer, I guess we have Eric Jenkins online.
Mr. Jenkins, are you online with us this morning?
Mr. Chair, this is John Dawson. I'm actually here as opposed to Eric Jenkins. Eric is my associate.
Okay.
I didn't expect to be available, but I am. I believe I can respond to the question.
If you'll introduce yourself and who you work for, John, we'd appreciate your clarification.
Certainly. I'm John Dawson with the firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I represent the the Providence Anchorage Anesthesia Medical Group. The short answer to the question through the chair is that, yes, provision J is in fact an exception to an exception to an exception. The only reason why it is structured that way is that the original exception referenced in E simply stated that if you go back and look at the original section E, it said that a physician may not, for reasons of conscience, refuse to abide by a DNR order. In other circumstances, a physician may refuse to abide by an individual instruction based on conscience, but DNR orders were not one of those types of instructions. I is basically saying, notwithstanding what E says, that is, notwithstanding that you are not ordinarily permitted to refuse to abide by a DNR instruction, you may refuse to abide by a DNR instruction if necessary, essentially to remedy complications arising out of your own services. So I is an exception to what E says. J is an exception to that exception that was requested essentially by those folks in the field who frankly don't want to have that discretion. Their concern was that that level of discretion complicated their abilities to perform emergency services in the field, and it was done in that fashion. That is, it was made a separate section because it was felt it was cleaner to do a separate section rather than to have the exception to the exception to the exception embedded within I.
Okay. Senator French, go ahead.
So just for the record, folks in the field, paramedics, firemen, police officers, are always allowed to perform CPR on an ailing person. And once that person gets to the hospital, then the do not resuscitate order kicks in. Is that roughly correct?
Through the chair, I think actually the reverse is what is contemplated here. If the individual has a DNR order, the person in the field must abide by the DNR order unless an online physician indicates otherwise.
Okay, I'm glad I asked then. And how would a person in the field know about the do not resuscitate order or wish?
Through the chair, typically that'll be in the form of some sort of a DNR bracelet or other indication on the person.
Through the chair, here in Alaska, we participate in the Comfort One program, and that has those attachments that he talked about, bracelets and other things to make the EMTs aware of your advanced healthcare wishes.
And boy, before you go in to have anything done, they want to make sure if you have one or not. Believe me.
Think twice before you sign one of those, I guess, is the real teaching point, but thank you.
You know, and I think this I is necessary. I mean, my goodness, it's necessary, or you got a doc in the box here. Got an error that could result in death, which could create liability, but no opportunity to correct the error. And by correcting the error that could have resulted in liability without this exception, you create another liability. So it's I think it's a good exception.
Other questions? We have Mr. Snyder here to testify. Mr. Snyder, welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator Seekins.
And if you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony.
My name is Mike Schneider. I'm happy to be here this morning. I practiced law in Anchorage since about 1975. The majority of that work has been on behalf of individuals and families injured as a consequence of somebody's screw-up. I have done very few medical negligence cases in my career. I suspect I've done five or six in all of those years. I also would like to begin by saying I just first saw this bill this morning, and I haven't had a chance to visit with Representatives Weirich or Dahlstrom, who I know to be serious, thoughtful, hardworking folks, to get a bit more of their perspective on what their goals were here. But my first overriding comment is that the bill's it's a solution in search of a problem. I can tell the members of the committee that though there aren't real accurate statistics kept in any specific place that I know of on these things, there have probably been about a dozen, maybe one or two more, probably one or two less, plaintiff's verdicts in medical negligence cases broadly defined in the history of the state and territory of Alaska. That's all. I have never heard of, I am virtually certain, I've got one of those verdicts, and like a number of them, there were many of those dozen are Pyrrhic victories. I have never heard of a verdict based on the kinds of liability theories that this bill seeks to address. I know of no claim having been made on that theory or paid, though I suspect there is a claim or two out there because Section 16 is a retroactive provision back to a specific date. That's, I guess, atypical in my experience looking at legislation, and I suspect there may be a reason for that, and I suspect that reason may have grown out of a specific suit, but I do not know. If I could provide some specific criticisms of the bill, I would like to begin with Section 8. And while sometimes in matters that cause me to come before this and other committees, my interest is primarily academic, I've been recently told that I should go out and acquire a new right hip. And so I, in light of that reality, I look at Section 8, and it seems that if a healthcare provider in the process of installing my right hip somehow nicks my femoral artery or otherwise does some negligent medical screw-up that then places me in a position to need resuscitation, that provider can decide to allow me to go on to my reward or not, even though their negligence put me in that position, and be immunized if their decision is no more than made on a good faith basis. Now, the first bill that the committee heard this morning, the number of which I failed to write down, we heard comments from the Department of Law, Ms. Carpinetti, I believe, that said that the good faith standard, I think she said, was problematic. Senator Huggins accurately observed that a good faith standard lessens responsibility and lessens accountability. And that's what's going on here. If we look at the language that's being deleted, there just isn't anything wrong with this language. Healthcare providers are supposed to make reasonable efforts with a level of diligence appropriate to the seriousness and urgency of the situation to ensure the validity of an advanced healthcare directive or a person's assumption of authority to make healthcare decisions for a patient. And the good faith phrase is still there. A healthcare provider or institution acting in good faith after doing this reasonable inquiry enjoys pretty broad immunity. I would like those folks figuring out if I'm going to live or die to be just a little bit more serious about it than pulling out the medical coin, flipping it, and relying upon this statute as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Section 9, you know, I was commenting on section, I think the criticisms I just voiced were more appropriately addressed to section 9. And in section 9, if the actor does not act with gross negligence, recklessness, or some goofy intentional disposition, they are immune. I had a couple of other.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
The way I read this, maybe I'm reading it wrong, is that good faith is in determining the validity of the advanced health care directive, not in how they deliver medical services.
I think you're correct in that. But in section 9, as I read section 9, if the health care provider negligently causes complications that give rise to the need for resuscitation, they can allow the patient, the victim of their negligence, to die, and under section 8, their interpretation of the advanced care directive to cover that set of facts is subject only to a good faith standard. That's the trouble, is that these things get daisy chained together. You can let yourself off the hook for your own screw up. I think when most of us sign advance directives not to resuscitate, we don't really envision that our need for resuscitative care is because we're the victim of medical negligence. We think it's probably that we're the victim of some advanced or debilitating condition, some accident like a stroke or heart attack. We don't think that that need arises because some doc sawn on the wrong leg. Under this bill, the physician has the prerogative to make that judgment call based on nothing more than a good faith standard, which approximates in this setting no standard at all.
Well, here I might need Mr. Dawson's help. As I read 9, if I read the first part of 9, which goes from line 9 through line, halfway through line 15,
mm-hmm.
says that if a do not resuscitate order prevents them from doing this because of complications out of it, there's no criminal liability or civil liability. But the subsection doesn't apply. That subsection doesn't apply if the complications suffered by the patient are caused by gross negligence, reckless, or intentional actions on the part of the healthcare provider.
Exactly. So all you got to do is add negligence in front of the phrase gross negligence, and I'd say it's an okay bill. But when you lessen the physician's responsibility to a level where, in deciding whether you leave this earth or have some chance of remaining, they cannot be criticized unless they grossly deviate from a standard of care the juries in this state have almost never found to have been violated. You're really putting the public, I would respectfully suggest, at the mercy of people whose good faith I will never doubt, but whose skill can be legitimately questioned from time to time.
Mr. Dawson, do you have a comment on that? Are you still online?
I am. Thank you. The Section 9, the premise of Section 9, of course, is that there is in place a valid DNR order. Good faith, I believe it was the chair that pointed out, the good faith requirement pertains to whether the DNR order is valid or not. It does not pertain to the services that are rendered. So the Section 9 begins with the assumption that there is a DNR order. And we are in a situation where, because of the existence of a DNR order and because of the desire of the physician to honor that DNR order, he does not correct what could be negligence on his or her part. But his decision is based on the existence of a DNR order. He's trying to honor the wishes of the patient, who understands that there may be risks in any surgery. And so we, if you begin with the idea, as the Section 9 does, that there is a DNR order in place, it's not the case of the physician deciding to do good work or do bad work. It simply says that a physician should not be sued if he honors a DNR order that has been put in place by the patient. It doesn't cover gross negligence, and I submit that sawing off the wrong leg would certainly be gross negligence. So it does not cover that sort of a situation. And I think that it properly places the decision back in the hands of the patients who put the DNR order in place, and also in the relationship between the patient and the doctor, where the doctor honors that DNR order because he knows that patient, and because under the circumstances of that relationship, he realizes that he ought to be honoring that DNR order.
Senator French.
Thank you. Mr. Dawson, but what about just a simple mistake? What about the simple act of negligence? You know, something far less than sawing off the wrong leg, but something which still results in the death, or at least the imperiling of a patient through, not through sort of a natural cause, but through an error in the operating room. Why wouldn't we include that as one of the things that can't give rise, if you will, to the usage of the do not resuscitate action?
Through the chair, the irony of your question is that the exception, if we were to include the exception for negligence, we would essentially swallow up the ability of a doctor ever to comply with a DNR order. And one of the objections the very nature of this of the act to begin with is that we want doctors to honor the wishes of their patients, and we at the same time we want them to honor that, we don't want them to be worried about liability when they do so. And so the reason why we allow this particular scenario where you have mere negligence is so that a doctor will not be worried about getting sued every time that there's a DNR order in place. He can honor the wishes of the patient, even in the face of potential negligence on his or her part. If you were to include negligence in front of there, really what you're saying is a doctor cannot honor the wishes of a patient, and that would run counter to the very purpose of the act in the first place.
Jacqueline?
I would say, you know, to put this in a little bit of context, these criticisms, you know, Representative Wyrock has been, you know, president of the Bar Association, and he's very familiar with the need for litigation and protecting the consumer. So this is not in any way a doctor exoneration bill. It's not. What it is for those people that have DNRs, they often have problems finding doctors that want to operate on them because they don't want to honor DNRs. It's immensely problematic for them. So if you have specifically in your DNR, grandma's going to surgery for her hip, she has explicitly written and said, do not resuscitate me. If I flatline under anesthesia, do not bring me back. That is her right to be able to do that under the current Alaska Act. But that does not say that the family, after that doctor honors that DNR, is not going to come back and sue that doctor. So why would a doctor ever honor a DNR when there could be litigation? Why, if grandma flatlines under anesthesia, would you ever? You would not. You would never honor a DNR because the instance of litigation would be too great. So you would never want to honor a DNR if grandma flatlined during surgery because of that possibility of litigation. And Representative Wyrock, it's not his intention at all, like I've said, to exonerate doctors, but he feels that this is a very good balance between protecting Alaskans to be able to make their advanced healthcare directives and have those honored by doctors who in turn are able to do so with a conscience that they'll be able to do so without unduly being litigated against. And I think this bill strikes a great balance. And, you know, we've really tried to get this through and make it a clean bill and be very near on the construction as we've gone through the committee process. And I think that this is a really good, by saying if they're grossly negligent, sure, let's, you know, litigate like crazy. But if they are just simply honoring a DNR and she flatlined, it's okay to just let her pass on if that was what she wanted.
Mr. Snyder, your body language tells me you wanted to make a comment.
So does Senator Gessis.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Snyder.
Name one verdict
name two claims. Ain't there?
Well, that can happen. It appears to be a great theory, reasonable solution, but I can't name them either. I just want to, that's why we're discussing it. Senator French? I mean, guess.
Yes.
I looked at French first here. I wanted to see if his hand was up because we always try to get the lawyer into the mix here. Senator Guess.
I don't think I can formulate my response yet, but I worry about justifying a bill under those circumstances. How about that?
Let's take a look at the, we're almost at the magic hour, so we're going to have to carry this bill over until tomorrow as well.
Spend some more time.
And we'll, tomorrow if we need to, we'll recess a little bit and come back and just have to address some of ours, or we got Wednesday. What's Wednesday got scheduled? Thursday.
Thursday, I left open to clean up.
To get clean up. So we'll back clean up on Thursday at the very latest. So let's carry this bill over now. And with that, Senator Guest,
yes.
You had a comment on Representative Lynn's bill.
If Representative Lynn's office could come up here, we...
Thanks.
In some of our amendments, not to offend the Math Now folks, but...
We follow math wherever it leads us. We're not offended.
From my understanding, and Ms. Parks and Mike can testify to this, we went to the drafter with the changes in the ages, and it's causing some problems for the drafter.
What is it?
So maybe it can be addressed, and we can...
Susan?
Sure, thank you. Again, for the record, Susan Parks, Department of Law. Mr. Luckup, the drafter of the amendment, his concern is, what he's indicating is, although the math doesn't appear to make sense, the use of the age 18 is simply an indicator of the age of adulthood, and that 18 is often used throughout our code as, you know, being of this age. Some of them we have being 16, but 16 and 18 are magic numbers. He says that's the reason for the use of 18, and
yep.
He does not recommend that the changes be made to 19 in the current CS or in the statute 1141440 as discussed.
Motion to rescind our action on the, or you want to?
Before we do
Senator
that.
Senator French.
I guess I'm just going to have to take issue with Mr. Luckup. I'm sorry he's not here. I'd rather do it person to person with him than through you. I know it's uncomfortable, but I'm looking at the first page of the bill, and on page 1, line 8, it says an offender commits a crime of sexual abuse of minor second degree if being 17 years of age or older. So I guess I would point out to Mr. Luckup that there are many magic ages in the books, and 16, 17, 18, and now we can add 19. And I guess I just don't see the danger.
Through the chair, and I'll go back to him. His other point was that when you look at that section that we're proposing to change, being 19 years... He said that being 18 years of age or older,
right.
That older helped the mathematics work out.
Yeah.
It does.
That was his argument.
I mean, it's sloppy, but it does.
I'm okay. You know, you can chart it out, but Mathematics Now says that no 18-year-old can violate this law. He can be 18 years, 11 months, 31 days old, and he can't break this law.
But Senator French, it also doesn't have any practical problem with staying at 18, besides that Math Now has an issue with it. I mean, you're still going to have to, you still have to do 3 years, so it would be 19, and there's 9 other places in the statute which refer back to this, not just one other.
I'm not
going to
create a problem for the bill. No. I just,
I think either way it works out, because you've got to do the math no matter what you do. And
but it sounds like a perfect bill for someone to introduce next year to figure out all the ages of...
No.
So,
I'm trying to work with you here.
I can understand the rationale, and I don't have any problem with it, but in order to do this, we'll have to rescind our action, remove the amendment, and go forward.
I will, out of the spirit of cooperation, I will move to rescind our action.
Is there objection? Hearing none. Motion to rescind the amendment to the bill that changed the ages from 19. Is there a motion to that effect?
Oh, yeah, I made a motion.
Okay. All right, motion's been made to rescind amendment number one.
Our action that we rescinded was to pass it out of committee. Now we've rescinded the amendment. Is there a motion now to pass the bill as unamended?
So moved.
Senator French has moved the bill to the next committee. Is there objection? Hearing none, as unamended.
Thank
and the Judiciary Committee